You are listening to the Venture Intelligence Entrevista series. This podcast features Hemu Ramaya, founder of the landmark chain of bookstores. And interacting with her is K. Satyanarayan, founder of New Horizon Media. The interview was recorded in June 2010.
Tell us a little bit about how it all started. What inspired Landmark? Apparently, you were working even when while you were in college in a bookstore.
Yeah. Actually, what I was doing is working at the Danai Bookshop at the Taj Coromandel Hotel. And I was doing that in the evenings. I was doing literature in college. And my only passion was to work with books. I wasn't quite sure. Bookshop was something that just happened, I guess. I would have either been in media or TV or editing, or but something in the book space, which I knew I wanted to do. But the bookshop was a perfect opportunity, and I could work the evening shift. Mm-hmm. And that suited me fine. So I used to go to college during the day, and I used to work in the evenings. And I just completely enjoyed it so much and decided that this was what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And decided to make a profession out of it, really. And I think to a deep disappointment of my parents, I have to admit, because I was like earning $350. And so they just simply couldn't understand why I didn't want to study more, why I didn't want to go to America, why I didn't want to do a master's, and all the usual, you know, routings. But in any case, this is what I wanted to do. I did part-time. The moment I graduated, I joined full-time. I made it, I was like a sales assistant, made it to manager in about a year's time. And then I opened 6 more stores. And in the process, I think, learned the core of the business. And to me, those years were, I think, fairly invaluable.
How many years did you spend?
8.5 years.
Okay.
In the hotel industry, in the hotel bookshop industry.
Okay. When did the idea of starting Landmark strike you?
It actually started in maybe 5 years down the line, 5 years into the business. Mm-hmm. What was really happening is, if you understand the sequencing of how this happened, is the hotel bookshop was meant for hotel clients, mm-hmm. which meant that everybody could mark up, and everybody did mark up. Mm-hmm. All hotel bookshops were about 15% higher than the rest of the market. Mm-hmm. But the irony of the whole thing is the people who were staying there were not necessarily tourists. They were business guys, expat and Indian. And what really sold was business books, because you're catering to that kind of person. And the common perception was they don't mind paying, so it's fine. Mm-hmm. But within a few months of joining, I kind of figured that you're dependent on the ups and downs and the cycles of the business environment. Because there were times the hotel would go empty. I mean, very low, you know, occupancy. And there were times it would be packed. So what happens to a hotel bookshop economically and financially when you're going through your down cycle? Which is what you realize, that it's not enough to cater to hotel clients. First of all, they're just far too few. I mean, they're just too few to make the business sustainable. There's no fun running the shop in the times when business is bad. So the logical thing to do was open the market and say, I want local people to come. Because truthfully, there weren't any bookshops. I mean, there was Hickenbottom's, there was Kennedy, all that was there. But the point is, you couldn't really get a range, you couldn't really browse, you couldn't open a coffee table book and look at it. Everything used to be shrink-wrapped and sealed and put away, and it was fairly intimidating for a person who liked books. So I wanted to do that. So the first thing I did when I took over, which is like about 6 months after I actually joined the business, was I spoke to the person I used to work for and said, look, I'm putting my job on the line. I need to bring prices down to retail, what we call MRP today, mm-hmm. was whatever is the conversion rate, whether it's dollars and pounds, whatever is the actual conversion rate, I need to convert it at that rate. The no, turnovers will go down, we'll earn so much less, that's my profit margin, blah, 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 blah. I said, yeah, but on the other hand, you'll also get local people coming because they come to the restaurants. And the Coromandel being so central, why would they not come and shop here? Because if you choose books well, and you talk to your client base and you allow them to browse, and I can't see any harm in it. Give it 6 months, if it doesn't work, we'll revert. And of course, I mean, like they say, the rest is history on that account. We were the first hotel bookshop to come down to. In fact, in the chain, the other shops used to sell at higher prices. Chennai was the only store that did, you know, MRP, I'm calling it MRP, but what it actually means is whatever was the dollar or pound, we used to convert into that. And I think that made a huge difference. We started getting local people in. It became a hangout. In fact, some of my customers, even today, are people who I met at Danai, not people I met at Landmark. So it was an amazing experience. It was great to be proved right. And I mean, it's a basic gut that said that why would somebody pay 15% more? I mean, it's something that irritates you. It's got nothing to do with affording it. I mean, I can maybe afford to pay you 25% more, but why? You know, just because it's available with you, and I didn't think that was right. So that worked. And then what happened is we built this whole, you know, it's like a destination bookshop where you could come and ask for what you wanted. And those were the times of complete shortages. I mean, you need to understand the environment in 1977 when I joined the book industry. There were two monopoly distributors in India. There was Indie Book House that did Brit books. There was Indie Book Distributor that did American books. And that was it. And they had two guys sitting, one in Bombay, one in Delhi or wherever, buying books for the whole of India, making decisions on what you and me should read, or assuming that you and me would like to read X and get in only that. When the catalogue of all these American and British publishers was so vast, I don't think they even understood it.
And they didn't do special orders then?
Special orders were unheard of. And air freight was unheard of. There are a lot of things are unheard of. It is actually quite a historical, I mean, the story of Landmark is quite a story from that point of view. Because there was nothing. People just did one big catalog order, all bestsellers only, and whatever they knew and whatever they were familiar with, put it on a ship, four times a year do imports, you know, take 3 months to land by the time it sailed in, and you cleared your, and then you transported it across the country. Once in 3 months you would get new stocks, literally. Okay, and to think that in England alone they publish 1,000 titles a week. This was the state of India, I'm talking in 1977. We're not a primitive nation. We are a nation of readers, and we've always been. So that was the situation. And then what happened, as I kept talking to customers, and I used to travel to buy books, because south of the Vindhyas was somewhere. It's not India, you know. It's not deservedly to be serviced by those guys. They would have branch offices with some pathetic stocks, which would come, like I said, once in a month, 2 months, some little replenishment. If you sold a title, you could not replenish it. So, I mean, it was unheard of. All these things were, you know, you just sold whatever they bought and hang the customer. I mean, his views were not important. So I used to travel to Bombay and Delhi to the wholesalers and to the people who imported just to buy books for the store. And I used to do this more and more and more frequently so that I could get my replenishment. I didn't have place to store. Don't forget, I was running a chain of hotel bookshop. At one point, I was running about 7.
What was the size of these shops?
About 250 to 300 square feet. Okay. Nothing more than that.
Okay.
And then I had to go back and buy more because, again, you know, there's no place. And you can't do these written orders because it never came. Stocks never came. And there was a sense of frustration of not being able to service the market. You're talking to customers. Right here you have this very upmarket client base that's ready to read and ready to buy books, and you don't have the merchandise. And you don't have the merchandise not because you're inefficient, because the whole system way up the line is inefficient. You know, they were just too, and it was a monopoly. And nobody else could go and import anything. So then I used to go to the publisher's offices and I used to pick up catalogs. And I used to go through the catalogs of hundreds of titles that they never imported. And I knew that I could sell in my stores. And I would say, look, can we get this? Can we get this? Can we do this? Can I do a special order? I said, forget it. Ones and twos and fives, I mean, that's all I could afford to, you know. Six hotel bookshops, how much can you buy? So at the most, even if I did one copy, it would be 5. And obviously, the Fisherman's Cove and all those would not sell the same amount. So it used to be anywhere between 2 and 5 copies of a book. And I wanted to try a whole lot, and I never got my orders processed.
Were there any requests from customers for books of this?
Obviously.
Okay.
In fact, if that was a generation, all of you, I think, are too young for me to, you know, explain. But when relatives went abroad, everybody, some people would say, get me jeans and get me perfumes. And there were people like us who would say, get me books. You know, which is really ironic that you have to ask somebody going abroad to say, get me titles right. that are not available in India. Mm-hmm. It was that much of a shortage. So that was how I think the seed of Landmark got planted. Mm-hmm. This frustration of not being able to get books, this frustration of not being able to buy more and stock more because the shop was too small and the client base was, you know, growing. And I think we built a fairly decent reputation mm-hmm. As people who knew books and people who were interested in just getting the right book to the right customer. I think the satisfaction that came out of that mm-hmm. was what Landmark was all about, you know. And trying to do it on a bigger scale, on a better scale, and saying less no's to the customer, and trying to say yes, you know, I've got it, or yes, I can get it, and fast. So which was really the concept. So if you ask me why the transition happened, it happened about 5 years, and it took me about two and a half years to plan the whole thing in my head. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it was a dream at that point of time to do a large store, to do it air-conditioned, and I understood the basic requirements for a store like this to work.
Had you visited any large store of this sort elsewhere?
Never. I had never been abroad. The maximum I'd been to Bombay and Delhi, and if you know Bombay and Delhi, the shops are much, much smaller than what Landmark ever was. They're all tiny little shops. They don't have large stores. Even today in Delhi, you can't find a big bookshop.
Mm-hmm. So it was a big leap of faith to go from 250 square feet to about 5,000
square feet. 5,000. I don't know actually, because there were several things I felt I was offering the customer in terms of value add. Mm-hmm. And I felt I knew the market because I was in the market for 8 years. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very critical thing for young entrepreneurs today. They, unfortunately today you don't have the luxury of time that I had. I can't say it was cakewalk for me. It took a learning period, a fairly long learning period. But I could have done Landmark in maybe 3 years instead of eight. But it was my background. It was my learning experience. And my mental cutoffs for starting a business in terms of age mm-hmm. was 30.
Okay.
I think we all have these little inhibitions in our brains that say, I can do this up to then, after that I won't, you know. Mm-hmm. And I genuinely felt that if I didn't start my own business by 30, then I would stay an employee. Mm-hmm. For one simple reason, that I wouldn't want to take risks. You get too comfortable, you get too set in your ways, you're not willing to experiment. And a whole lot of other factors. So 30 was my mental cutoff. And as my 7th, 8th year in then I started approaching, I realized that, okay, I've got this idea, but I need to do something about it quickly. Otherwise, I'm just going to let it pass. Mm-hmm. So which is why the whole concept of Landmark started in my head. Mm-hmm. I'm saying, ideally, what I figured was people who came, local people who shopped, not hotel clients, came in a group. Came in families. Mm-hmm. India even today likes to shop as a family, especially in a bookstore. Okay, you'll have the entire family coming to shop. The next thing was different people like different things in the family. So I knew I had to do the store multi-product mm-hmm. because there are lots of young kids who don't read or don't want to read or are too young to read, but want some other distraction, which is why the toys and, you know, all the other stuff came in. And multi-product it was from day one, simply because I felt it needed to work. And then air conditioning, again, because I worked in a hotel bookshop which was air conditioned, and I had seen all the bookstores out which were not air conditioned. Mm-hmm. In fact, everybody else air conditioned, like, I don't know, decades later, you know. Simply, one is of course the convenience, and you know, because the weather in Madras is the way it is. Mm-hmm. But one is that, and the other thing is the sanctity of the book itself. You know, the place was less dusty, it was, you know, in better condition when you bought it, let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. So air conditioning was a basic requirement, and that was an expensive decision to make, because 5,000 square feet, it needed to be at least that much, mm-hmm. because I needed to do multi-product, needed to have a little back office there to process stuff, mm-hmm. needed to be air conditioned, and most important of all, I think it needed to be computerized. Mm-hmm. At that time, in 1985, when I thought of Landmark, I don't think there were retail stores that were online computerized at all. I don't think there was a single retail store that was computerized. Mm-hmm. But for me, it was life and death. And I couldn't afford people who knew books. So I knew you're starting with base level A. And just the amount of titles that I wanted to keep, looking at the catalogs, I mean, they just were boxes and boxes and boxes of catalogs, and I wanted to do at least one to three copies and hoping with a larger store and better purchase, these importers would actually do, you know, some special orders for me.
Were the hotel bookshops computerized?
I don't think they were. They were not.
So you had not been using computerized.
No, it was more like a billing machine. Okay. You know, okay. There's no online
the
stocks. Yeah, no
right.
stocks or nothing like that. Okay. Now that was the critical thing that you know because obviously this is one trade where the customer is far more erudite than you are, mm-hmm. or you can ever be. Mm-hmm. He knows much more. He's going to come and ask for a title you never heard of. You don't even know how to spell those names, mm-hmm. neither the author name nor the title name. So you just simply needed to query it. And the kind of stocks that we were planning to keep or I wanted to keep. So online computerization was something. That was, I think, one of the biggest and most difficult decisions and most difficult implementation processes in Landmark for me. I mean, it looks easy on the outside, but for me, it was a complete novice. I'm not a science student. I was hopeless. My math is pretty weak. But you know, for a person who did it to try and implement this, and nobody knew anything, because I had no previous experience. Mm-hmm. I was not emulating anybody, I had no one to imitate, I had no role model, it was just coming out of the top of my head, saying, I know my customer needs this. And so that was how Landmark started.
Did you have people who were known to you, or did you go out looking for...
I went out looking for people. Doing the store, I knew I needed it open and large and spaced out, and you know, people needed to browse. One thing I did want was I wanted to be more like a self-service store, which didn't exist in India, because till then bookshops were all counter-based. You needed to go to the store and ask for the book, and the guy would take it from the hand and give it to you. Even fiction, strangely, was sold that way. I mean, you would think textbooks are sold that way, but even fiction used to be sold like that. And a coffee table, forget it, there was no way you could open one. You had to see it and just flip it around, it was shrink-wrapped, and if you bought it, then you could open it. The situation was pretty bad. So it needed to be self-service, in the sense it needed to be accessible, all books needed to be accessible, which is why I designed the open rack, as you saw in Landmark, in the first Landmark in 87. And anyone could go to it. We had categorization, we had headers, and you could go and you could browse. And if you couldn't find it, then the one thing we did was a help desk, which is there in every store till today. Mm-hmm. Every section will have a help desk. So the book section would have one or two help desks, because there are so many inquiries. And you could query your database, and it was online. This whole process of online or batch itself, I think, took me about 3 months to resolve. Mm-hmm. Because everyone does batch processing in the world. What's with you? I said, yeah, but the book sold in the morning and I'm querying it in the evening and you're going to batch process at night. Well, what am I going to tell the client? I'm going to give him wrong information. I'm not even going to be able to meet a need. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you need to understand, I just didn't know how this worked. I just knew what was right for the customer. Mm-hmm. I didn't know how to go about it. So I went out and... hardware was much easier to do than software. And software, even today, if you ask me, even today, in my consulting, in young entrepreneurs I meet today, A, they underestimate the value of software. Mm-hmm. B, they don't know where to get it at a price they can afford. Mm-hmm. And C, I don't see too much in the market that exists. And I'm talking 33 years after I entered retail. Where are we going wrong? But it is a fact. So software for me, I think, was the most difficult thing to find. I got quotes from 18,000 rupees to 12.5 lakhs to do the software for what was going to be Landmark. From a variety of companies. How the hell do I know who can execute? Because in software, strangely, even today, people promise you the sun and the moon and the stars. But what they actually produce is something quite different. And the time they take is again quite different from what they promised to do it in. So I can I empathize with entrepreneurs today who try to get, you know, computerization done. So for me, that was difficult. And then what really happened among all the people I met two young guys just out of college, okay? And they were working on some kind of a banking software, and they just started a company, a complete startup. I'm giving you this example because I'm trying to say that gut feeling plays a big part in what most entrepreneurs do. There's no logic in what they do. At least it seems so. But there is some and substance of, you know, a background to the decisions we make. So what I'm trying to say is, if you're making a decision that is different from what everyone else is thinking, just go ahead and make it. You know, most times you're right. A couple of times you're wrong, but it's okay. But that's your mistake, not someone else's. So I still prefer to do it that way. So there were these two young guys, and who, in the briefing, you know, for me, my gut instinct said, they were understanding what I was saying. I met all kinds of companies, big brand names, whoever was there, everybody I met, because for me, it was a critical part of my business. But I wasn't quite so convinced with anyone else I met who was making a sales pitch on software as I was with these two kids, because I was saying they're getting the feel that I have for my customer. They're beginning to understand what I'm wanting, and they're willing to try, you know, and they feel confident that they can do it. And more important than all of this and the money and everything else is the fact that they were intellectually challenged. And I appreciated that. I still appreciate it today. Anybody who's willing to come and give a good idea a try, you know, is something that excites you just to see that in somebody. So for me, it was, for them, it was a new business. At the same time, it was also an entry into the world of retail. So they also understood that, that if I get this right, then I'm going to get the formula right for retail. So there was a synergy that we worked with, and they finally did my software, and it was an invaluable part of the software. I must still say that we have one of the better operating softwares of all the bookshops in the country, of all retail stores in this country, not even bookshops, I would say all retail stores in this country. It works.
Could you tell us a little bit about the nuts and bolts of book retailing? You know, how does the business work? You know, where do you source the books from? How, who gets paid how much? What's the value chain like?
Not quite different from most retail, but the difference here is the margins are high. But like I keep telling people who want to jump into book selling, because the margins are high and they think it's you know, it's an easy trade to get into, it's not. Whatever margins there are in an industry are there because of market conditions of that industry. I think people need to understand that. You know, if a toothpaste margin is low, it's because the bloody thing sells in like in 3 days. If the margin in books is, you know, 35% or 40% or whatever you might try and swing, it's because it takes that much longer to sell. And you keep that much more of inventory. And it's so complex, the whole thing. So, in all the categories that we stocked, books being the highest margin, and, you know, gaming, stuff, gadgetry, like your Xboxes being the lowest margin, that was the chain from low to high, that was the margin chain. And like I said, at the point that I started, there were only two importers for books. You had to go to them for whatever you wanted, but all that changed along the way. I think Landmark did the yeoman service in opening what we call Western Books in 1993, is when I started Western. And I started it for a variety of reasons. So, if you want to sequence it, then I won't talk about it now. But
That's fine. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. What actually happened is when I opened Landmark in '87 and it was so successful as a single store, I told you there were two distributors in England. One was Indie Book Distributors. They actually opened a store down the road called Fountainhead. Okay, thinking that, look, I can keep my wholesale margin and I can keep the retail margin and I can make much more money than these guys. It's a logical thing to do because it's what people do. But unfortunately, they didn't have the wisdom or the vision to say, let me just be one more player, okay, and let me grow the market. See, this is another thing I would always say. The moment you're selfish about your industry or your business, in a limited market, and you don't want to grow the market, and you don't want to rise above that, my shop, my company, my profit, my somewhere it hits you and it hurts you in the long run, which is what really happened with Fountainhead. is they opened it, which is fine. I actually, even till today, or even till the day I sold, welcome new retail. Because what it really does is the more bookshops you have, the more the market grows. Mm-hmm. Instead of saying it's taking away my business, no, it's not. It's growing my market, which is the way I always looked at it. But they got preferential pricing, they got preferential timing on new releases, they got preferential everything. And I started getting my old customers coming and complaining, and said, what the hell are you doing? You know, down the road is cheaper, and they get the books faster, and they get their magazines 2 weeks before you. And I contacted the owner like 2-3 times, and I said, look, you can't do this. You know, I have been buying from you for so long, and it's not fair to my customer as well, because he is your customer indirectly. Oh, that's not possible. Maybe they buy directly from Bombay, all the usual stories. I tried this 2-3 times, but they didn't do anything about it and continued to happen. So for me, it was just plain and simple survival. Either I had to do something about it or collapse. Which is why I said, no, I have to do something about it. Then I had this friend who was the South Indian distributor for the British part of the imports. And I said, look, you guys do only British books, okay? This guy does American books, has got a monopoly for the last 22 years in this country. And I think there's a market out there.
In what way was it a monopoly for him?
Because it's all territorial and it's all agency based.
Okay. So nobody else could actually start out as a distributor?
No.
Okay.
You can't.
Okay.
Even today, it's all territorial. Even today. Only thing is slightly more open market, in the sense they have distributed that open market, they've opened their offices in India. But all this is the history of bookselling in India. And like I said, it is an interesting story. So I spoke to him and I said, now we need to bust this, because I'm not going to get supplies. Customer's not getting what he wants. All over the country, the reading habits of each state are so different. And this guy doesn't have a clue. No, let's just go and try and open an account. Can we form a joint venture company? I know what sells. Mm-hmm. I have a pulse of the market because I'm dealing with customers on a day-to-day basis. You know the business of importing and distributing. Mm-hmm. Let's do it. Mm-hmm. So he said, fine, I'm only doing Brit books and nothing that stops me from doing American. Let's give it a shot. Mm-hmm. So very bravely bought a ticket, went off to the LA book fair. There's a big book fair that happens in America called the American Booksellers Association Fair, which is the ABA. Mm-hmm. And
Which year was this?
1993. Okay. So in all, you can call it innocence or you can call it ignorance, but we got these tickets. This is our first trip abroad, okay, into the book world. Landed up at this book fair thinking, you know, people would say, wow, India, okay, yeah, I'm going to open accounts for you. And we're very, very surprised to find that nobody gave us time of day. And every stand we went to, it was like an experience, because these are all guys we're looking at catalogs and buying for the past so many years. And then you go to a Simon & Schuster, go to a Random House, and there's a woman right up there in front at the book fair in the stall saying, hey, who do you want to meet? And we say, well, anybody, I mean, international marketing or international sales head or whatever. I said, do you have an appointment? He said, no. Appointment, we didn't think of it. We've come all the way from India. I said, forget it. These are all booked 3 months in advance, and you're not even going to meet anybody. Oh, it was, I think the first one was a huge eye opener for us, and went around and had a look and took cards and stuff like that from the girl in front. And the next book fair was Frankfurt. Now, this happens in May. The next big book fair in the world is the Frankfurt Book Fair. So then, we came back all wise and smart and wrote to everybody and said, okay, now we need appointments. Some gave, some didn't give. We landed up at Frankfurt and we went for these appointments. We sat down with these international sales heads and they said, where are you from? India? Oh, we're very happy with our India arrangements. And, you know, like, short of saying, where's India? Where's that? You don't want to know. You know, we have an account in New York. Mm-hmm. And this importer actually had an account in New York and used to pay there. And we don't know where India is. We don't know if you guys will pay. We are not even interested in knowing who you are and what you do. Accounts and all, forget it. We are not opening. We're very happy with our India arrangement. So we badgered them and said, but they're not importing anything. They're not importing the range. Customers ask. So no, very, very happy with it the way we are. So we don't want to change. Oh, then we made a few friends and then we said, okay, we went back for the next ABA. This is 1994. And had made a breakthrough with somebody from Random House who at least listened. And said, but that's all fine, I understand what you guys are trying to do, I appreciate what you're trying to do, but there's no way I can do anything because that's the way it works, you know. Unless you have an account in America and unless you're paying us there and we don't want to know, no one comes to India, we don't care. But then we came back and we were figuring out what to do. And then we realized that unless because we're just talking about what these guys are not doing, we're talking about what we can do, but we're not actually documenting anything. So we said, no, we need to do something different. So we sat down, it took us a week. We just picked one account. We picked Random House, which is one of the largest, publishing groups. Took the Random House catalog, which you had collected at the fair, that they give away very freely. Okay, they don't charge you for that. Came home, sat on our computers. For one full week, we did a Random House indent, an actual order of what we wanted to import. And it ran into thousands of titles of small quantity. Threes and fives still. We hadn't changed that philosophy. But small quantities. No, we took this order and we wrote to them and said, we want to come to New York. We don't want to come to the book fair. We want to come to New York and meet you in your office. Would you give us an appointment? So they did. Okay, you want to come? Come. So then we took this little order and we went off to New York. First trip again. And found that, you know, they were not so rushed because it was not fair time. So they actually sat and listened and we ran through the entire lot of titles and say, check your computer system. None of these titles have ever entered India. And I think the Indian customer deserves more. So went through this and all the rest of it and they went through the entire order. They did find that none of these were being ordered. And then they said, look, but these quantities are far too small. How can we give you imports, allow you to import such small quantities? What happens to my distributor? It's not going to work. So you figure out some other method of upping the quantities, because if you don't, then there's no way we can open this account for such a small order. So then we went back and said, okay, we'll think about it and come back to you. We went back and we discussed it. And that time, I think I made again what was for me one of the milestone decisions in the history of Landmark. I decided to import and I decided to distribute, to make my numbers. I said, I will supply my competitors, I will wear a different hat, and I will grow my market. And in the process, I will grow my brand. I think it was a big reckoning change I made. So when that happened, we went back the next day, completely upped the quantities and said, we will supply all India, give us distributorship.
So you made this decision overnight sitting there.
Yeah, it was a big decision to make. Because what it actually meant is I was going to give away my knowledge bank, okay, of my field with my customers to my competitors. I was going to, when I first went to America to open this account, I thought I would have books that no one else would have. And so Landmark would be unique. And so everybody would come to me and not go to anyone else. But I had to change that attitude. Because I wouldn't have got the books without making this decision. Because they didn't want to open the account for a single store, which I felt was fair enough. So that's when I decided I will wear a different hat and I will distribute. So then we decided we'll start a different company. Then they still had doubts. And they said, no, you're saying all this, but there'll be conflict of interest. You will keep the best books for yourself and you will not give it to other people. And then we will get complaints and we're going to disturb our arrangement. You know, we just believe you guys know books, you know what you're talking about, but we think there'll be conflict of interest. And we said, look, we're very ethical in what we do. Give us 6 months. If you get a single complaint from any bookshop in this country that says that Landmark got priority supplies, you take away the agency. We're willing to put our reputation on the block. Which they thought was okay, so they opened the account on a trial basis. So we learned to live and learned to walk in the distribution business by focusing more on our competitors than on us, you know, which again is, I think for me was a huge learning experience. It just allowed me to expand my my thought process to say, there is a market that I need to grow, okay, by which Landmark will survive. I think it has held me in great stead. And I think it was a lesson. Came to me by default, but it was a lesson. And we actually started designing a distribution, we would have a new title distribution chart. In every zone, we would have the leading bookshops and say, how many did they buy? Mm-hmm. Even if the guy missed a good title, a lot of bookshops would say, I don't want this title, I don't want this. We had the procedure was we would pick all our new title, take one copy each, and the sales guy would go to them and say, here's my box of new offerings, they'll just come in. Mm-hmm. So lots of them will say, I'll take two of this, I'll take one of this, I won't take all these. Mm-hmm. Even if they didn't want it, we would say, boss, you please take it, because we didn't want the complaint coming up later. Mm-hmm. We would say, please take it and keep it in your store. If it doesn't sell, we take it back. But keep at least one each, mm-hmm. so that if a customer asks, you will have it. Mm-hmm. So that was an uphill task, trying to change the mindset of the people who bought in among my competitors. But we had to do it. And the sales guy would get shouting and say, you know, so-and-so is not bought. Mm-hmm. They don't want to name stores, but they were big brands that didn't buy great titles simply because they didn't know them. They had no clue what these books were all about. And here we were, sitting and looking, and there was no internet. There was nothing those days for us. So it was, all quite different. Now that was how Random House opened, and seeing the success of Random House, we went into, Random House started with some $100,000 and ended up being about $3 million. They really grew mm-hmm. at the India market. Seeing the success of Random House, other guys came in and the whole market opened. They started actually visiting India and visiting south of India, which was a big deal because people came to Delhi and flew back. Mm-hmm. Started visiting the south. There was a point when I left Landmark in 2008 where every month we would have at least three visitors from the US or from the UK. And India is a huge market for them now. But it needed someone. I think Landmark, in a way, started Westland with East-West, mm-hmm. and that actually opened the book market in India. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we continued in the same monopoly stream. So that was one big revolution, as far as I was concerned.
Okay. How did you go about, starting the business? Did you have a written, plan of some sorts, or did you... just have it all in your head and then get started?
Actually, all in my head. Okay. I won't say there was a serious business plan, not the way I see now, mm-hmm. and no analysis the way I do now. Mm-hmm. Today I would analyze a business plan. But it was more back of the envelope. Mm-hmm. And even today, if I wanted to start a business, I would first do a back of the envelope, mm-hmm. and only then I would actually translate that into a business plan. I feel that gut thought always works out right.
How did you go about funding it? Finding the funding for...
We never got funding. So in today's terms, what we call bootstrapping, mm-hmm. you get on your knees and beg and plead with family, friends, please have some money. So basically it was, we never got funded. Landmark never took a loan for a long time.
So you had what little money you put in, helped to get you to profitability quickly enough?
We were profitable from the beginning, from the first day we actually did well.
Okay.
And we opened on December 13, 1987, and I think we did about 65 lakhs by March, which was much more than we expected, which was big mm-hmm. in terms of turnover, mm-hmm. because I couldn't afford to take a retail space. Mm-hmm. I took the basement. Those days, today you have retail happening in basements. Mm-hmm. But I think we were the first people to start a basement retail store mm-hmm. with no name board. Even till today, we don't have a name board. Mm-hmm. So the Inunga Markham store is the cult store. Mm-hmm. It has absolutely no signage, no access, because the landlord refused to give us anything. And that was actually warehousing space. Got it at $4 a square foot mm-hmm. and decided to take a call. And Inunga Markham High Road was boondocks. They were like 5 cars an hour, maybe, huh? Maybe less in the evenings. Because the place to be was Mount Road. But we couldn't afford Mount Road. So we took one of the crossroads. So that was that.
So you've been profitable right from the beginning?
Yeah, I think we are one of the only or very few retail brands in this country made profit every single year that I have run the business. 21 years.
Do you think it is still possible to do something like that today?
Start today?
A retail business which can get to profitability?
Sure. You need to have the right idea, the right time, it's serendipity or whatever you want to call it, but it's possible.
Okay. How did you go about finding people to work for you when there was no other store of this sort, there were no people who had experience in this thing, in these kinds of things?
We just hired whatever came. We had 18 people. I started the shop with 18 people. Mm-hmm. And if I remember right, not a single one of them was a graduate. They were all school pass, college dropouts. I think it was an incredible family. And most of them are still there in Landmark today. In the first 18, lots of them are still there. Some have left. Some have migrated, but I think one of the success of this of the store was the people we had. Because one thing I've never believed in is in looking at an academic degree to hire somebody. I don't think I ever did it. Not in my 21 years, I never done it. You know, when I started, there were no department. Mm-hmm. It used to be really funny, and people used to call because we used to the corporate setup. People. Can I speak to somebody from the marketing department? Can I speak to somebody from the purchase department? We are everything, yeah. 18 of us did everything. We ran the shop floor, we did the billing, we did the cleaning, we had a couple of boys who helped, and we did the reordering, we did the unpacking, we did the deliveries, we did everything. So there were no departments. So we all learned and we all grew. And
how did you train people? I mean, did you have any...
On the job, on the shop floor, and it was just about service, more service. It was, I think we never lost focus on the customer. It was the key to the brand.
When did you think about going beyond one store? Was that something that you had right, when you started the business, having multiple stores?
Was it there? No. Frankly, no. We just wanted to do this one large store and have one large happy family, make lots of money and be happy. That was really, there was no great business plan. But as we went along and we found that we were getting customers, actually I just want to mention one thing, one big decision that I made which led to what Landmark is or built the brand for it was in 1990-91 maybe. What happened was we had a foreign exchange crisis and margins were put on imports. And at that point of time...
Can you explain what that means?
What that means is the book trade is an open credit trade. If I can open an account with Random House today and I can get 150 days credit. No LCs, no nothing. That's the way the book trade works. And that's the way we've always worked. Suddenly you have the government of India saying, boss, we have no foreign exchange available. So what are we going to do? If you want to import 100 rupees worth of books, you will put 200 rupees worth of deposit down with me, which is called a margin. It was done to discourage imports. It was done to allow, to make people think before they frittered away foreign exchange, which the government didn't have. And so that was crisis. And it was really a crisis which nobody knew whether we'd get out of it. Nobody knew how long it's going to last. And it's fine to put a margin on people who pay, who open LCs and put up money anyway to do imports or prepay invoices. But to put a margin on an industry that's used to 150 days credit was a complete shocker. The whole industry went into panic. So they started returning stocks. They said, we can't buy anymore. Imports completely halted. Nobody bought. If you wanted to get books, you would have to pay the margin to the importer. And it was like complete chaos. At that point of time, what I did was I went on one trip all over the country to everybody who had inventory. And I picked up everything that they had which was worth buying. And I actually cleaned out warehouses. I rented a space in Madras, brought in the stock and warehoused it. And for the first time in my life, took an overdraft of 65 lakhs to fund this great stocking operation that I did. Because my basic logic was, if you don't have books to sell, how the hell do you run a bookshop? Which is what everybody should have thought, but they didn't. They panicked. So picked up all the inventory and built the brand within 6 months of Landmark. It is incredible. I had people from Delhi, people from Bombay, people from Calcutta, people from all over India asking us for books. And everyone said, if you want a book, it'll be at Landmark. You won't get it anywhere else. people called, people mailed, people wrote letters, people wrote postcards, people, and we would courier books and mail books and speed post books, and it was an amazingly glorious time of shortage, but it was a glorious time of selling books.
And if you had all the books.
Oh, it was incredible, and we had a lot of stock by those standards. That was when we did one quantum leap in our selling, in our book selling numbers, because people just came from everywhere to buy books. So that was, after that of course, I think it lasted about 9 months and it all worked out, and then the market opened. But we also were importing.
So that was a good brand building opportunity.
Absolutely, brand building. So, you know, you have to look for these, everybody has these in the life cycle of your business. You will always find an opportunity like this coming. You just need to think against the tide, and I think it will pay off. Because at the end of the day, you're customer focused. So that worked. And as far as the second shop concerned, yeah, we were like scared as hell because I'd never borrowed money. Again, philosophically, it's a different generation I belong to. So whether it's good or bad, I don't know. But we were taught never to borrow money. It was evil to borrow money. It was greed. It was, you know, you just use any word you want. It was not right. It's not the done thing to do. You cannot owe somebody money to buy something for yourself. And there was no such thing as EMI. There was no such thing as, you know, buy now and pay later and fly now and pay later. And all that didn't exist in my time. So to have borrowed money to do this kind of operation for me was quite frightening. And I could not spend any more money till I had paid that back. But there were people saying, why didn't you do a store here? Why didn't you do a store there? And we didn't have the money to do it. We weren't, you know, all our money was going back into building inventory. We started with fairly low inventory. All the money we made went into stock, which was, that was about 1988 was when I met my husband, and he's a chartered accountant, and he could just simply never understand my business. You would look at it and say, you're the classic, you know, the word book profit came from here. All your profits are in books. You make more profit, you buy more books. Make more profit, you buy more books. There's just nothing coming out of the business. But we needed to build inventory, because the more we bought, the more we sold. And there was a direct link between inventory holding. So we kept growing the stock. So then we were so cash strapped because we were paying back over, trying to reduce our overdraft and stuff like that. When we got a franchise offer from Coimbatore, somebody we knew. Four women got together and said, we have the money, we have the space. And I thought this is just like perfect. Mm-hmm. And went and had a look at the space. It was on Avinashi Road. And we said, okay, fine, now let's try the franchise concept. At the same time, I didn't want to handle the entire supply chain and say, I'll make money out of it, which is how normally franchises work. You make money on the supply. I said, no, principally that didn't seem right to me. And I said, no, I will not make money on the supply. You just give me a percentage of your turnover, whatever, 2-4%, whatever. You just give me that and everything else. I will open the supply chain to you directly. Big mistake. But like I said, we all make mistakes. So we opened the supply chain completely, and then we had a whole lot of issues, which, you know, led us to say no more franchises. At the end of it, we said we will never do another franchise. And Landmark won't do another franchise simply because we are not controlling the supply chain.
What were the learnings you had in terms of mistakes that you made?
Many mistakes. Because, you know, one basic thing I must tell you, there are contracts and there are contracts. There was a franchise contract, which is a fabulously drawn contract. But the fact of the matter is, how do you enforce contracts without treading on toes, without breaking relationships, without going to court, without doing things that you don't want to do? This is not what you want to do in your day-to-day life, because you want to run your business and you want to get joy out of what you're doing. All this for me is negative energy. So no matter how much you plan a contract, how many ever clauses you put in, if you want to enforce it, you're going into what I call negative energy. That is not what I wanted to do. And it's that I think was a big learning. Because I can say, you need to pay your suppliers according to the credit terms that we set. Mm-hmm. Fine. Then you should, because you've signed a contract, right? Mm-hmm. But if you don't, then what happens? I can't stop your supply because I've opened the supply chain for you. So that supplier would call me and say, boss, I can't supply you, I'm going to hold supplies because I've not got paid. And store maintenance. I might say in my contract, you must paint your store once a year. And if you don't, what do I do? I might say this is the minimum wage you must pay to get basic people and they must be trained in Madras for at least 2 months. But if you don't, what do I do? What do? You can enforce a contract, I agree. But unpleasantly. No enforcing of contract is ever done with grace or with happiness or with style or with, you know, with success. It's always a bad, thing at the end of the day. It doesn't leave you happy. But after all, I mean, an entrepreneur does business to also be happy at the end of the day. So franchising for me was a big mistake. Like, you know, of course, in retrospect, I could have said I would control the supply chain. I would do this. I would make money on everything that I gave you. But that also didn't seem right to me, principally, because I'm not the proprietary owner of that merchandise. I'm only trading. I'm not a Zodiac, I'm not a Van Heusen, I'm not a Arrow. I'm not making my own product and saying, okay, I'm giving you my merchandise. If you don't pay me, I just stop supplying. But it's not like that at all. This is someone else's merchandise. Publishers all over the world are publishing books. So that was a learning. But what we really did was just contract expired and we just gave it off to them. The store's still running. It's not as if it shut down.
The same thing in Calcutta too?
Calcutta was different. Calcutta again was at a point that we were at a point that I had decided that by which time I had started traveling and I felt that India needed malls. There were no malls in India at that time. And I said we need large floor plates, we need large stores, 5,000 square feet was too small, needed to do much larger stores. And it was it was the circumstances that brought my partner into Chennai for some family function. He came into the store. He loved it. And he said, you must do this in Cal. That was the time the real estate had nosedived. So he had this huge building which was empty. And he said, please come because it's dead. Nobody's going to open. Nobody's going to do anything.
Which year was this?
This was in 1997. I had just expanded this landmark into double the space. We'd bought the space. We'd doubled it. Introduced music and this was going gung-ho, and this was like 12,000 square feet. And this was, I was running out of space. So I knew we needed large format. So we needed to get a little bigger. That's when he came and offered me the 20,000 square feet. He said, we'll do it. Then he said, I'll take a franchise. So no franchise. That's one thing I don't want to do. And he said, then how to do it? So then I racked my brains. I said, find me another method, you know. I'll rent the space from you. He said, no, I want to do it also. I want to be part of it. I don't mind investing. So then the only thing we could work on was a joint venture. I said, okay, a joint venture can't be so bad. Let's do joint venture is another experience altogether. So we did a joint venture. And the space was his and we paid some normal rent and we did it jointly.
So when you looked at going to your second store, what was the thinking? Did you want to do it in Chennai itself? Why did you look at going to any other, bigger city? Did you think about these options before you started your second
store? I did, but again, I'm telling you, I was convinced that the format had to be large for future stores. I was convinced that a mall was the way to go. I was convinced that that was the way people will shop in the next 10 years. And all our stores are there for long periods of time. And that was when Spencer Plaza had just opened, yeah. First phase had opened, it was quite a mess. Second phase had opened, it was a little better. Third phase hadn't opened it yet. And that's when there was a guy from Spencer's who kept, I used to go there just to see the so-called mall. I mean, Spencer Plaza today even also, it's not really a mall, it's a bazaar. Mm-hmm. And apart from the fact that the air conditioning is so bad, all the rest of it, it's a fantastic bazaar. It's the way Indians like to shop. It's not a mall. I don't even like to call it a mall. It is beyond. If only they could fix those little problems. I think it's a great place to shop. And much more interesting than a mall. Because in a mall, it's like formula today. You see, the same brands in the same locations. And, it's all too packed and too formula. But Spencer Plaza are not like that. I used to go and I used to see these crowds of people, these busloads of people that used to pass through. Nobody wanting to buy, a lot of people shopping, a lot of people not shopping, but it was a fabulous place. And it was 2 kilometers down the road from my shop. And then they kept saying, you must do a store here. Because in Nungambakkam, we were doing some 7,000 people a day. And on weekends, some 10, 12,000 people a day. And malls love that kind of traffic. So they used to keep saying, come and take space, we give you space. So finally I said, okay, let's go look at it. We went and had a look at it. And looked at a space. And the rentals just weren't working out for me. In spite of the fact that it was highly subsidized. But it wasn't working out for me. So
which year was this?
Around 1999. So we did all the numbers on the rent, and all that happened. Every 3 years rent went up. At the end of the ninth year, I was almost double my rent. And you know, I would constantly be working for the landlord, and I said, I'm working out. And then I got this brainwave, and I said, because what they've done is that the entire second phase, they had this long strip, and they weren't able to sell it. Unfortunately, it was not a rent model, it was a sell model. The whole Spencer Plaza is not working because of that. They never took deposits, you know, and the entire space was not selling, the main corridor. So what they did is they just made a small little strip in front, and they divided into little blocks and sold off the entire frontage. Mm-hmm. And there was this huge space at the back which had no access to the corridor. And they didn't know what to do with it. So that's when I looked at the plan and I said, okay, now I will buy. You give me this, but give me a price that I can afford. Okay? And joined to that was the third phase, which gave me the frontage and gave me the access and gave me the atrium facing. Mm-hmm. So I said, I will take this and I will take that. And then we worked out a deal, and it was a great buy, and the numbers were working for me. So I wanted to do the store, and it was 40,000 square feet. Mm-hmm. And that was the time we were talking to a private equity player to invest in our business. Mm-hmm. And we also were making a kind of a business plan to take a store to Bangalore. So then when this deal started happening, then that guy came back and said, if you're going to do Bangalore, fine, the deal's on. But if you're going to do Madras, and you're going to do Spencer Plaza, the deal's off, because it's down the road and you're going to cannibalize. I said, yeah, but that's a different audience. I have stood there like for 8 months. The people who come there are not the people who come to my store. They're different and we're different. Maybe 2 kilometers, but it's completely different. He said, no, it doesn't work like that.
Was this person somebody who was in Madras, or was he from somewhere else who didn't understand this?
No, it's the way all people thought. Okay. It's got nothing to do with him being an investor, but all people thought that way. Okay. Thought we were foolish to open the Spencer Plaza store. Mm-hmm. And put so much money into it. Mm-hmm. Borrowed money, like, till here for the first time in our lives. And, like, were really hassled till the store opened. But we did it. And we opened it. And then that was again one major change was the design of the store, mm-hmm. which we had to go away from the landmark Nungambakkam look, because that was small. You could get away with, you know, 2-3 base colors. I just wanted it to be a vibrant store, wanted it to be happy. And so we just, if you've seen Spencer's when it opened, every section was a different color, a different floor, different ceiling, different lights, different. It was quite an interesting store. I'm not saying in retrospect maybe we would have done it a little more stylishly, but it was like fun to do the store. And people loved it. I mean, the store made money from day one. We repaid our loans in 3 years. And having bought the premises, that was the, you know, jewel.
Was that a good decision with hindsight, buying the place instead of renting it?
But that's a slow method of growth. Today, retail companies won't buy. They all rent. But then everybody's got one fire under their bottoms to open 30 stores and 300 stores. For what reason, I don't know. You can do 30 stores and be hugely profitable and be very happy running your business at a scale at which you can handle, rather than do this other thing. And I think a lot of retailers have made those mistakes. Grown for the sake of growing, borrowed money for the sake of borrowing money, doing unviable locations because you didn't get better locations. I mean, these are retail mistakes.
Did you, you know, pay yourself dividends or, you know, some sort of returns?
Never.
So it was all money was going back into the business all the time.
Into more books. never paid ourselves dividend. But, I mean, there wasn't that much to, you know, pay. But and if we started paying ourselves dividend, then we would have had to borrow. Mm-hmm. So it was self-defeating. Mm-hmm. I think most entrepreneurs, young entrepreneurs, won't pay themselves dividends.
Now, you were talking about, talking to private equity players. At what point of time did you, think about raising funding from external investors?
Around Spencer's.
Okay.
We were getting a good valuation, but like I told you, the guy ran away when he decided.
Mm-hmm.
When he heard that I had decided on Spencer's, he pushed off.
Okay.
He said, no, not a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
So we said, fine.
Subsequently, did you pursue external investment as an option?
No. A lot of people came to us, especially after the Bangalore store opened. Bangalore happened because of Spencer's.
Mm-hmm.
Bangalore opened in 2003, I think, February. And that was our flagship store. That was like 50,000 square feet. But I think I pretty much decided not to go for a private equity player because I was also looking at when did we open? 2001, 2003, Bangalore opened. Within the next 2 years, I was looking at selling equity, but I was not looking at private equity at all. I wanted a strategic investor because I wanted by the age of 50 to exit the business. Okay.
How old were you then?
In which year?
At the
2005.
Time.
2005. No, 2005 actually sold. 2003.
Right about the time when you were considering this.
About 46.
Okay.
My cutoff was 50 in my mm-hmm. head. I have these cutoffs in my brain. 50 was my cutoff.
Mm-hmm.
Wanted to sell. Actually, we wanted to exit the business earlier if we got a good price. And many times, Mahavi and I would sit and talk about, I'm sure this is something that all entrepreneurs have done. You want to exit and you want to do something else in life.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, how much is enough to retire? Okay, I've had this discussion with hundreds of people who say, at what point do you jump off this treadmill? Okay, business is a treadmill. Yeah, we enjoy it. If I worked for another 10 years, I would have enjoyed it. It's a great business. I loved every moment of Landmark. But do I regret selling? No. So how much is enough? Of course, that number keeps shifting. The more you shift, you'll start maybe 25 years ago, maybe 1 crore was a hell of a lot of money. You'll say, oh yeah, that's more than enough. Then the one will become five, and the five will become 10, the 10 will become 25. And so then we figured, we said, look, if you want to be sensible, okay, it's better to put an age cut off than to put a money cut off,
mm-hmm.
right? Mm-hmm. So we said, because you can keep on shifting that number, no?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like I said, 10 becomes 25, 25 becomes, and it's not that you can't make it, you can make it.
Mm-hmm.
You just work that much harder and you put in that much more and you do another 3 stores. So it's very easy to go to that 50, it's very easy to go to the 100, it's very easy to go.
Mm-hmm.
But your life is passing you by in that process.
Mm-hmm.
So then we said, no, let's put an age cutoff. Age cutoff being 50.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever there is at 50, let's just go. Be happy and start a new life. Because you're still young enough to think, you're still young enough to contribute to society and do whatever else you might want to do. You're still young enough to travel, you're still young enough to enjoy your children and to read and to do whatever, you know. So the cutoff for me became the age more than it did the quantum of money one would make.
Mm-hmm.
Because after a point you don't spend money,
mm-hmm.
you know. So this thing of whether you want to make 100 crores or 500 crores is absolutely irrelevant. I mean, it's very relevant when you're 25 years old and you want to, think big. But as you get older, the years have gone by and the money becomes more and more irrelevant. It's a very strange thing that happens to us. It's more the pride of what you're doing, the pride of leaving behind a good business or a good brand, and you move on. Most people don't understand. Everywhere I go, people ask me, why did you do this? They don't understand.
So at that time, you were talking to investors, you said, but not private equity, you said.
No, I look for strategic, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I look for strategic, and when I look for strategic, I look for strategic for 2 reasons. One is, a strategic player would be interested in the business, would value add in my business, give me a perspective that I wouldn't have had by myself, and most important of all, would let me go at the end of a period of time and continue to run the business in the same way that I would have. That was the idea. So that's why I was looking only at strategic players.
And
otherwise, in the private equity routing, you're in a loop. Because if you're the private equity player, you'll buy, say, 40% of my company, then I'm stuck there. I need to perform for you to exit with some decent amount in your pocket. And how will you exit? By selling to another Johnny like you, who'll put in money and he'll expect me to stay for the next 3 years to make money for him. And then he'll go and I'm there for the next 3 years to make money for the next guy. I just didn't want to be in this loop. And I said, no way, I'm not. Because private equity guys don't want to run your business. They just want to make their margin and move, which is fine.
You've said at some point of time that supply creates the demand.
Yeah. I actually believe that.
Could you expand on that a little bit?
I think Landmark was a classic example, mm-hmm. completely classic example of that. If you ask me when I opened in 1987, did I do a market survey? No. Was there any way I could have known what people wanted to read? No, apart from the fact that I had my finger on the pulse. But when you provide a customer experience and give them a range of stuff that they've never seen, I think it works. You know, if you don't stint and you don't stinge and you don't, give off an experience. Most retailers find it very difficult to give. I'm saying just give. I mean, there are little things that you don't think of, you know. Simple thing like, when we started our, our customer ordering service many years ago. It was a whole software module. It was a beautifully designed software module that was so customer friendly, not funny. I mean, if you ordered a book, no matter when it came, no matter which branch of India it came, my system would tell me, Satya's book, now name this, ordered on so-and-so date, has now entered the Baroda store, one copy. It will automatically generate one thing to say, please pick and ship. Early days, you tend to say, pay me for courier. Yeah, I'll courier the book to you. Then you think about it and say, what the hell are you doing? You know, it's still companies, you're not able to put into perspective that what is that courier cost? It's nothing. So just pay for it. We charge courier for about maybe 6 months or something, and then we figured, I mean, how idiotic is this? Mm-hmm. You just don't charge. And you add it all up and it's actually nothing. It's a cost of one money add in the Hindu year. Sometimes we just lose perspective in business is what I say. When you don't think customer, you think you're looking at your numbers all the time and your accountants are running your company, then you lose vision. You need that entrepreneur to override that and say, it's not a big deal. You know, just pay for it. Just do it.
So when you've expanded supply, how do you bring in new customers? Did you do anything to try and bring people who are not yet readers to turn readers? How do you get more people into the store?
The biggest satisfaction was that. The biggest satisfaction was the multi-product store. Which meant that anyone in the city of Chennai, for example, was a potential customer, right? Mm-hmm. And unlike any other industry, you can walk into a bookstore 3 times a week and all 3 times you can find something new, right? Mm-hmm. You cannot say that in any other store. You cannot say it in apparel, you cannot say it in supermarkets, groceries, just name it. You cannot say that anywhere else. It is such an interesting trade. So what we did was, we did hugely multi-product, and from Spencer's we started the home section. That kind of took all the women in and just completed my customer base. There's just everybody became my customer. And then what you do is, when you enter, you design the stores in such a way that when you enter, my original idea was that what I call the new arrival rack, that changed every day. Okay. Every day something would go out and something new would come into that. So that meant every day if you walked into the shop, every day you could find something new. So that was a new arrival rack, if you're in a hurry, right? Now you pass the book section and you go and do whatever shopping you want, if you're not a reader, I'm assuming, okay? And I'm hoping that after 10 times, some cover, because they're all face-ups, it was designed to attract the non-buyer, non-reader. After 10 times of entering the store, I would expect you to pick up one and just read the blurb, and that would make me happy. Then you put that back and you go away, And after another 10 times, you might, you know, get into the habit of reading the blurbs of 10 books every time you came and go away. But someday, you will be a reader. And for sure, I think lots of people have converted because of this talk. I'm sure of it. Because I have stood and I have watched. That new arrival rack was the converting point.
How do you see the internet retailing of books compared to what you've been doing in physical retail?
How was it or how is it going to be? What's your question?
How did you see it when it first came up and how do you think it's going to shape out?
See, I always felt it would be big. In fact, we started Landmark on the Net in 2000. We didn't have any money. We were doing our expansion of stores. So I went to SIFI and said, you pay for the software, you pay for the search engines, you host it, and I'll upload your thing with my new stock position on a daily basis, which is the way we did it. So it wasn't great because people didn't want to use their card. So we introduced cash on delivery, which worked. But lots of cash on delivery worked for the customer, didn't work for us because a lot of people didn't, they ordered it to mine, they didn't actually collect it. So then I was paying courier 2 days. So it didn't actually work out, the cash on delivery. But the card will work and started working. But then, you know, we had issues with SIFI and the search engine. And after that, we decided to do it on our own. So right now, it's a standalone site. But if you see the range of stocks in the bookstores today, which are getting weaker and weaker by the day, simply because, if you ask me, I think accountants are taking over the book industry, which is a sad state of affairs. And they're not allowing stocks to be held the way they should be held. They're not allowing backlists to be held. Because the moment they see the book is a year old, they all go into deep panic. And their blood pressure goes stratospheric. The more they do that, the more efficiently they block old stocks from staying in the stores, the more efficiently digital and online business will grow. Simply because you have no access to stocks. You're going back into a deprivation zone. The way it was 30 years ago. But books are available on the net. I buy books on the net. Simply because they're not available. So the next step is obviously digital. It's eco-friendly. It's fast. It's cheap. And it's brilliant. So it's the way people will read books in the next 3 to 5 years. I'm completely convinced about it. And the starting point is accessibility. The starting point is not convenience. Convenience is now.
So if accessibility is actually going to be affected because the book range is shrinking, then do you think physical stores will slowly also shrink?
Logically, yes. We didn't just exit for the money. But people are reading a lot more, I find. People are really reading. Because the wonders of the internet have changed the way you think. No, you don't need to go to a bookshop and browse and place orders and wait endlessly and for books that are never going to come. It's like, you know, waiting for Godot. Now you can buy what you want on the net.
How did you manage your home and your work? Did you find any kinds of rules that you used? Or did you come up with ways of dealing with it which you think others would benefit from?
I don't think there's anything spectacular. All have problems. The one convenient thing was I decided not to get married till I started my business. It helped keep the distractions away. I mean, something you have to give up, no? So I got married very late. And then having got married, I'm still very involved in my business. Decided not to have a kid till I was like quite old. And having had my child when I was like 40, I had my daughter when I was 40. And having done that, I decided to sell when I'm 50, so at least I'm around now for her. So that is it. There is balancing required, but I think if you want to do it, you will do it. And in my case, it was easy because I used to take my kid to work for many years. She used to come with me, so that was a nice environment for a child to grow up also, I thought.
What are the opportunities for entrepreneurs today in terms of learning how to get into an entrepreneurial venture and how to deal with it?
I think the atmosphere today is a lot more conducive. I do a lot of mentoring programs. I work with TIE, I work with CII. I've just actually worked with CII in the last year, brought out a book, an entrepreneur's handbook, which covers all your, you know, investment possibilities, all your funding opportunities. Banks, VCs, angel, venture, private equity, all the listings, all are there in that. So, I mean, we never had all these aids and tools when we were starting out. And the banks are a lot more friendly. And the kind of industries you can get into today, yeah, as an entrepreneur, are infinitely more than we could. Our opportunities are very limited. But today, with the digital age, you can do a zillion things. And if your idea is great, lot of angel funders will fund you. Lot of people, of course, they take away equity, but lot of people will fund you. Lot of people will mentor you. Government programs are there. And as a woman, you get a lot of funding. You know, small amounts, but many opportunities are there. And venture capital funding is pretty big now. In the 1 to 5 crore range, a lot of people fund. And in the mid-cap, there's a little bit of an issue. But after 30 crores, again, a lot of people fund. But lots of opportunities to get fund. But you need to have an idea. And you need to push it and execute it quickly. And valuations are good. You know, we never got valuations when we were... I mean, nobody dreamt of what people get today. Today I was reading about Ajay Piramal's article. He got 9 times revenue on his business. 16.5 crores he invested. 17,500 crores is valuation. I was reading his interview today. It's just unbelievable. Could you think of this 5 years ago? It's so good, the opportunity today. Landmark sold equity to TVS. I work with TVS Capital Funds. We vet a lot of private equity proposals and the retail space. Things are happening. It's much easier to scale up today. Logistics are easier. I mean, roads are being built here. You can move stock from point A to point B. It's so much easier in India today.
Thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us.
You are listening to an AltaVista podcast. For more such entrepreneur interviews, visit www.altavista.in.